I'm going to read from 1 Samuel chapter 22. First Samuel 22 and the 6th verse thereof. When Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered, now Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah, with his spear in his hand and all his servants standing about him. Then Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? All of you have conspired against me, and there is no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there is not one of you who is sorry for me, or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day." Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul, and said, "I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine." So the king sent to call Ahimelech, the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests who were in Nob. And they all came to the king. And Saul said, "Hear now, son of Ahitub." He answered, "Here I am, my lord." Then Saul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait, as it is this day?" So Ahimelech answered the king and said, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law, who goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Far be it from me. Let not the king impute anything to his servant, or to any in the house of my father. For your servant knew nothing of all this, little or much." And the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." Then the king said to the guards who stood about him, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell it to me." But the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. And the king said to Doeg, "You turn and kill the priests." So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck the priests and killed on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. Also Nob, the city of the priests, he struck with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and nursing infants, oxen and donkeys and sheep, with the edge of the sword. Now one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priests. So David said to Abiathar, "I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul, 'I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me, do not fear. For he who seeks my life seeks your life, but with me you shall be safe.'" Amen. Word has reached Saul. David has been discovered. Saul has a vendetta against David. And in verse 6, we come across a rather unpleasant scene. We're told in verse 6, Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah, with his spear in his hand and all his servants standing about him. This is a dangerous situation. Saul is rather adept at using a spear.
He cannot with it touch the Lord's anointed. And yet he has something of a habit of hurling it at people who don't say what he wants them to say. So I imagine these servants standing about him are a little bit jittery, a little bit nervous. The 26th of Proverbs and the 9th verse says, like a thorn bush in a drunkard's hand is a proverb in the mouth of a fool. How much more a spear? And Saul proceeds to make four appeals to Israel, or rather technically to his own servants, against David. And it doesn't behove a preacher to spiritualize too much of the text, but I'm going to draw a distinction here, or rather a similarity, between Saul's four appeals and the appeals that the devil will make when trying to dissuade someone from calling upon Christ. In verse 7, he begins, and Saul said to his servants who stood about him, hear now, you Benjamites. Saul has gone to the trouble of surrounding himself with his own people. Like many tinpot dictators, he feels that everybody has it in for him. Everybody is conspiring against him. And he's surrounded himself with his own people. And he's appealing now to their tribal identity. He doesn't appeal to the Israelites. He doesn't appeal to the Jews, who are, of course, at this stage, only 1/12 of the Israelites. But he's appealing to their racial loyalty, their clan loyalty. We are Saul's people. We are of the same clan as Saul's. We're all Benjamites together. We Benjamites, we stick together. I don't want you running after David. We need to stick together in these difficult times. And I put it to you that this appeal probably doesn't work a great deal in Britain. But let me tell you, there are countries around the world where if you go to church or you claim publicly to be a follower of Christ, you are accused of betraying your own culture, your own identity, your own race. You are disloyal. You're no longer one of us. You're going after the white man's religion. And Saul here is appealing to these people to ignore the man whom God has called to be king after Saul. He makes a second appeal. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? Saul now is appealing both to their bellies and their purses. The son of Jesse presumably will not give them each fields and their own vineyards. He will not promote them all to be officers in the army. Saul is implying that he will, although there's no evidence in the text that he was particularly generous at awarding fields and vineyards to people. Clearly, you can't promote everybody to be officers in the army. But he's suggesting to these people who are surrounding him under the tree that if they were to stick with Saul, they'll be richer, they'll be happier, they'll be better fed, they'll have grander titles, they'll have more authority. Does not the devil make an offer like that also? How many people do we know who are too busy to come to church because they've too much work on? Of course, they wouldn't see it like this, but I cannot but hear the voice of the devil telling him that the fruits and the riches of this world are far better than anything Christ can offer. Let me tell you, the inheritance we shall one day enter in is far better than anything this world can possibly offer. But Saul is apparently bribing these people. Stay with me. Don't go to David. I'll give you this, I'll give you that. He'll give these people whatever it takes to prevent their going after the one whom God has chosen. Thirdly, he appeals to their sense of loyalty. All of you have conspired against me. Does he not sound like a spoiled child here? All of you have conspired against me. There is no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse, including, presumably, Jonathan himself. And these servants are standing around Saul, looking uncomfortable. They're being accused of helping the enemy, assisting David. His own son has turned against him. We are turning against him. That is what Saul would have these people think. And he's appealing to their sense of loyalty. I'm mindful here when Pilgrim meets Apollyon in his progress. And he asks him, what was wrong with the wages I paid you in the city of destruction? Was I a bad landlord? Come on, go back now. Go back. He also appeals to their sympathy. There is not one of you who is sorry for me. Ah, bless. Poor Saul. My son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait, as it is this day. Hasn't Saul got it the wrong way around? Isn't it Saul who's been trying to kill David? In fact, in the future passage, David spares Saul's life. Have you noticed how some people judge others by their own vile standards? They assume everyone is as wicked and hellish as themselves. And Saul's understanding of being a king is that if you have an enemy or a rival or someone who's better than you, you eliminate them. And Saul therefore assumes that David must have the same view of kingship as he does himself. But of course David has no such view. For he is a man after God's own heart. God has called him to be king over Israel. Yet he sits back and waits for God to fulfill his own word. He doesn't try and remove Saul or bump him off, as Saul assumes he does. Well, in verse 9, Saul strikes gold. He finds someone who is willing to yield to his four wicked appeals. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. Doeg is a clever man. He has made himself the most popular man at Saul's court. These vineyards and fields that were talked of in verse 7 may soon be coming his way. Promotion in the army to a captain of 1,000 or a captain of 100. Surely Doeg is the man to fill that vacancy. And we live in a world, not yet in this country, I thank God, where people can become rich and well esteemed for denouncing the people of God, for betraying Christians to the authorities, theirs and his words result in honour for him and them, but death for those who would seek the Lord. He talks of the priest inquiring of the Lord, which I don't think is mentioned in the original narrative. And Saul acts on the information in verse 11. He calls for Ahimelech the priest, and all of the priests, in fact, to come before him. And the text doesn't say it, but I imagine that Saul may well still be armed with his spear. He likes his spear. Hear now, son of Ahitub. Notice he hasn't sent for David. David's the enemy here, so Saul thinks. Why doesn't he send for David? Well, presumably those 400 malcontents who have made up a kind of army for him have put Saul off. But the priests of Nob have no such defenders. You see, Saul is a bully. He starts with the weakest. He starts on those who have none to defend them. These men of God are easy pickings. He answered, "Here I am, my lord." Saul said, "Why have you conspired against me? You and the son of Jesse." He can't even bear to say David's name. "In that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day." Notice that Saul cannot say David's name. Neither can he use the covenant name for God. He says not the Lord, he says God. Saul's relationship with the Lord is so strained that he gives him the less personal title. Saul, once more, is judging others by his own standards and not by God's. He's assuming that the priests of Nob are as scheming and murderous as he is himself. Helping a hungry man has now become an act of sedition. Ahimelech defends himself in verse 14, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law, who goes at your bidding and is honourable in your house?" Ahimelech is a brave man. Here he is speaking truth to power. In the 6th of Mark, we read in verse 17, "For Herod himself had given orders to have John arrested, and he had him bound and put in prison. He did this because of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, whom he had married. For John had been saying to Herod, 'It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife.' So Herodias nursed a grudge against John and wanted to kill him. But she was not able to, because Herod feared John and protected him, knowing him to be a righteous and holy man. When Herod heard John, he was greatly puzzled, yet he liked to listen to him." Here is John the baptizer, denouncing sin. Not just in a general way, not just of the poor, but denouncing the sins of the rich and the powerful, even Herod, to the extent that he makes an enemy in Herod's unlawful wife. Why is it that John was able to stand up to Herod? Because John feared God more than Herod. Why is it that Ahimelech is able to answer Saul truthfully and in ever so polite a manner rebuke him? "Who among all your servants is as faithful as David?" Saul does not want to hear that. You know, Ahimelech could have told a lie. "Oh, my lord Saul, you're absolutely right. He forced me to give him that bread. He is a traitor. You need to do something about him." He may have been promoted for such words, but he speaks the truth and stands up for a man who's unable to stand up right now for himself. He describes him as obedient, honourable, and faithful. All words with which Saul is decreasingly familiar. Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Far be it from me. Let not the king impute anything to his servant, or to any in the house of my father, for your servant knew nothing of all this, little or much. Not only is David an honourable man, but Ahimelech the priest has done nothing wrong. If Saul were slightly more honourable, he might have complained that Ahimelech had fed to David the showbread, which should only have been given to the priest. But Saul missed that trick, because the correct and proper worship of God is again something with which Saul is not familiar. Of course, even if he had tried that accusation, Ahimelech would quite rightly have defended himself. The king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech." That's a trial for you. I don't know whether Ahimelech knew he'd been summoned to trial. He's had the accusation. He is allowed to put forward something of a defence, but unfortunately, I suspect the judge on this occasion, who is also the jury, made his mind up long before the defendant ever arrived at court. "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." So not only will Ahimelech die, but all those relatives who weren't even present on the occasion will die as well. And this, of course, is a wicked act. And yet, at the same time, the wickedness of Saul on this occasion is the instrument of God's judgment on the house of Eli. In 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 31, we read, "Behold, the days are coming that I will cut off your arm and the arm of your father's house, so that there will be not an old man in your house," said of the house of Eli. Sometimes God uses wickedness to achieve his own purposes and desires. I think of the book of Job. At the end of the book of Job, Job, I put forward to you, is not just a richer man in terms of oxen and she-donkeys. He's a richer man for having spoken with God and considered the trouble of this life. We've looked quite recently at the messenger of Satan, the thorn in the flesh, with which Paul grappled. And here, wicked Saul is unwittingly fulfilling the word of God by pronouncing judgment upon the corrupt family of Eli the priest. However, it doesn't go quite as smoothly as Saul anticipated. He orders in verse 17 the guards to turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell it to me. Well, they didn't know. And even if they did, why did they have a duty to tell Saul where David was? But the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. Here we have the servants of a wicked king who are clearly made of nobler stuff than he. They refuse to follow an unjust order. How many concentration camp guards in the late 1940s told their judges that they were simply following orders? "Oh, he told me to do it." Well, these men plead no such excuse. Ahimelech has spoken truth to power. And these servants also speak truth to Saul. Not perhaps with words, but by their deeds, or rather the lack of their deeds. By refusing to obey Saul here, they are acknowledging that there is a higher authority than the king. And that authority is God. Many people today who don't believe in God don't like using the word atheist. And that's partly because atheist is a negative term. A means non-theism. I do not believe in theism. And it characterizes people by what they don't believe instead of what they do believe. And so some people who don't believe in the existence of their own creator prefer the word humanist instead. I believe in humanity. I believe in the human spirit. It's atheism, but with a different label. But the difficulty with the word humanism is that it implies that there is no higher authority. We are the masters of our own destiny. The human race, the human spirit. We are what there is in the universe. Whereas the theist says, you show me the greatest emperor. You show me the most powerful king. And I'll show you one who's yet more powerful. And these guards, by refusing to obey the orders of Saul, because they know that by attacking the priests of the Lord, you will invoke the wrath of the Lord, they know that Saul is powerful. His spear is not far away. He's vengeful, malicious, and obsessed with non-existent conspiracies. However, there is one in heaven to whom they will give account. And they refuse. Touch not mine anointed, and do my prophets no harm, says Psalm 105. The servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. Now, there is, of course, a gentleman in their midst who's on an upward trajectory in terms of his career path. So the king said to Doeg, good old Doeg, he gets all out of any difficult situation. You can rely on Doeg. He's my kind of man, thinks Saul. You turn and kill the priests. So he does. All 85 of them. Ahimelech, gone. The other priests butchered. Those who wore a linen ephod. God is approached through mediators. This linen ephod representing the priesthood, the priestly garment, the priestly dress. If you want to approach God, you cannot. Because your sin is so vile and offensive to him. You cannot come any closer. And before Christ came, men approached God through the Hebrew priesthood. Let me tell you today, our sin is as vile as theirs. And if you want to approach God, if you want to enter into a relationship with him, if you want to have the fellowship with your creator for which you were made, you too must enter. Not through 85 men wearing linen, but our great high priest who was crucified and rose again from the dead. He is the door. He is the gate. He is the way. He is the truth. He is the life. Through him, we can reach God. Through him, we can bypass the seraphim of Eden. Through him, the sons of Adam gain more blessing than their father lost. Israel, Old Testament Israel, was there to lead the nations to God. Doeg was in the midst of Saul's court that he too might find the God of Israel, like Naaman the leper. Instead, Saul used him to conduct massacres. Saul's motives are wicked, but of course God foresaw what would happen and pronounced judgment on the house of Eli. So Saul has still done a wicked thing, and yet God received some glory. Also, Nob, the city of the priests, he struck with the edge of the sword. Doeg really is a man after Saul's own heart. Not content with the butchering of the 85, he goes and finishes off their families as well. Men and women, children, nursing infants, even the animals with the edge of the sword. Saul hates that priesthood. His wicked heart knows that it's a symbol of Christ, just as David is a symbol of Christ. To the extent that in verse 20, one of the sons of Ahimelech, named Abiathar, escapes and flees to David. Abiathar will feature quite strongly in the narrative later on. Where else could Abiathar go? There's no point going to his own city. Doeg's busy killing everyone. There's no point appealing to Saul. Saul pronounced the death penalty. And so David, the fugitive, has now become a refuge for others. David is pretty weak right now. But again, it's when we are at our weakest that we are most useful to God and most serviceable to his people. Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priest. So David said to Abiathar, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. And David there is referring to the lie he told to Ahimelech. Sometimes we think that a little sin, a little white lie, it won't do any harm. But it does. Abraham went to Egypt and lied about his wife. And it caused a great deal of grief. David told a very convenient lie. I put it to you this morning that God can forgive you and I in Christ of any sin. But the consequences of that sin we must sometimes live with. In verse 23, we have words of grace. If Saul earlier echoed the promises of Satan, so David here echoes the promises of Christ to we who believe. Stay with me. Do not fear. For he who seeks my life seeks your life. But with me you shall be safe. These are the words of Christ to sinners. The enemy brings death and destruction. But those who flee to Christ need not fear. For their lives are safe with him, and he will not let them go. I thank God that in this nation, believers have not been persecuted for hundreds of years. But there are so many countries around the world. We're reading from this book, or sitting in a meeting like this, or singing the songs that we have sung, would land you a prison sentence or worse. So as we close our service and we sing our final song, let's have a care for believers who were persecuted. And after the service, we'll have a care for those who don't yet believe, but by the grace of God, they will do.